Michael, welcome and please take it away.
Thanks, Daniel. Yeah, it's a pleasure to give this talk today. So thanks a lot for inviting me. Yeah, and sorry that I'm doing it in a remote way, but hopefully I can get my main points across. So yeah, as Daniel said, I'll be talking about modeling and using waveform uncertainty, like how to fold that into analyses of gravitational wave events. So let's see. So the thing I want to focus on is, so why are we interested in this? So ultimately, we want to do inference of gravitational wave events. And to do that, we need a few things. We want to infer binary parameters and using Bayesian parameter estimation. In this setting, you need a noise model and you need a model for your waveform templates in order to extract that information. So for the noise, I'm just going to assume the standard thing that it's Gaussian and stationary. But for the model, I will want to focus on what the options are. And the reality is that we have quite a few waveform models which are approximate models. So they have some error, and in some sense, it's not as small as we would like, but they are very like usable and generic, and you can evaluate these models anywhere in a reasonable domain in the parameter space of binary black holes or more general binary neutron stars and so on. So so let's call that these kinds of models capital H of lambda, and lambda are the waveform parameters. On the other hand, we have highly accurate simulations from numerical relativity, and we don't have these waveforms throughout the parameter space, but only at isolated points. So let's say we have a couple of thousand of those simulations that we trust, and let's call those little h of lambda. And now, if we want to do inference on events, we need to choose a model, and we can't really do that directly in the usual way with the NR simulations, because we can't evaluate those everywhere in the parameter space. So what we do instead, what we've done so far, is like inference with approximate waveform models. But we also know then, since these models are not as accurate, the inference may be biased for certain events. And so the goal then would be to reduce this biasness of the posterior distribution. And one way of doing that is to incorporate the model uncertainty into the inference. And here's an example, just to give you an example of what systematics could look like, and then we want to get rid of that situation. So this is from a study with Karl Haster from 2020, where we looked at parameter estimation for a 15.0914-like binary black hole signal in a sequence of detector networks that become more and more sensitive. So looking into the future towards third generation detectors. And what we've seen for the signal is that some parameters can be biased. This analysis is not using the latest and greatest waveform models, but what was available at that time. So this is ARMA Phenom PV2. And we found that there was in particular one parameter where we saw a significant bias. And so this is in this plot below on the left panel, you can see two effective spin parameters, posteriors for those, and in this precession-related parameter chi p, we saw that there is, if you go to sensitive detectors, there is indeed a bias, and it's getting the value for chi p that we know is the true value in the simulated signal of 0.3. It's really getting that completely wrong. Okay, so this can be a problem. Even with the better models that we have nowadays, I suspect that there will be cases like more extreme binaries, like more asymmetric in mass ratio, higher spins, where this would still be the case.
Michael,
the second, yes?
Yeah, sorry, please. I'm trying to understand a little bit better this example. So I assume, mm-hmm. Correct me if I'm wrong, that you're injecting a signal like GW15 or 914 with a given model. And then you search for it, and then you get bias parameters. So, but why you conclude or say from there that there is accurate requirement on the waveform? After all, you use those waveforms for your templates, and you're injecting with that template. So the waveforms could be 100% wrong if you're looking for them. Why the conclusion is that the waveform has to be more accurate? I don't understand.
Okay, so yeah, sorry. I should have explained it more clearly. So what's shown in this, what's shown on the left, the signal is a synthetic binary black hole signal constructed from the most accurate waveforms that we have. So in our simulation, plus a little bit of PN in the early in spiral. So a hybrid waveform that's processing. So that's the best we have. But that's juxtaposed with the like the standard models that we use for parameter inference that are fast enough and that we can evaluate everywhere. In this case, it's a phonological model. And that was used for inference. And you can see that for future detectors, also like for advanced LIGO, it gives the wrong answer on this signal. So I'm not, of course, I don't know what the true signal is for 15914, but we're saying that the in our simulation is going to be a pretty good approximation to that.
And so right? That statement doesn't refer to the waveform you injected, it refers to the effective models you're using to populate your template bank.
No, so this is relating to the difference between the injected waveform, which is like numerical relativity waveform, between that and the model that we're using to infer, the template model that we're using to extract what the parameters are in parameter inference, right? And so this phenomenological model that we're using here is not as accurate as the NR waveform.
Okay.
So there will be differences.
Thank you.
Okay. So that was the first point. Second point I wanted to make here is that this translates into some accuracy requirements for the waveforms for the future detectors. As the detectors become more and more sensitive, of course, our waveforms must become more and more accurate in order to avoid the situation that we have biased posteriors. And I don't really want to explain the details of that figure on the right. But it's just telling us, in summary, that we have to increase the accuracy by several orders of magnitude in terms of a mismatch, which is something I'll define in a moment. It's sort of related to the inner product between two waveforms. Okay, going a bit forward then, you can ask the question, how can we avoid the situation that we have biased posteriors? How can we mitigate that? So first, I think we should understand a bit better, like, where do the waveform errors come from? And that relates to how are we building waveform models. So certainly there will be different inputs that are used in the construction of waveform models. And that's, on the one hand, numerical relativity data. And it will be some analytical information from post-Newtonian theory, self-force, and so on. And these inputs will not be perfect. And on the other hand, of course, in the modeling process, we are also adding some errors because of the particular ansatz we make for certain functions, certain parts of the waveform, decompositions that we do, and then when we fit free coefficients to NR data and other data, we're making some additional errors. So this is what I mean by waveform errors in praxis. Now, of course, the one thing, the simple answer would be to avoid these systematics. What do you need to do? You just make the models more accurate. Okay, sure, that will have the effect, but it's also becoming more and more difficult to get to that accuracy. We should still try, and we, of course, doing that. But a second path is to augment these waveform models by including some modeling on what the errors are in the models. And so it's some additional degrees of freedom that parameterize the errors in the waveform models. If we have that information, then we can fold that into inference, and then we can correct our result in a certain way. Okay, so that's the basic idea. As a little preparation, just wanted to define a few quantities that relate to measuring distances between waveforms. So there's a natural inner product in the Fourier domain between waveforms that I'm sure most of you are familiar with. And it contains in the Fourier domain two waveform strains, could be from a detector, could be from a waveform model. And it also contains the one-sided power spectral density of the detector noise. And then based on this inner product, you can maximize over time and phase shifts that are usually not interesting and define this quantity called overlap or match. And this is a quantity that's between 0 and 1. If it's 1, then it means H1 and H2 agree perfectly. Now, if your values are very close to 1, it's sometimes useful to look at 1 minus this overlap quantity, and that's called mismatch. Okay. So now coming to how can we actually model waveform uncertainty? So there are different approaches, and I want to start with one which is very elegant and was put forward in a paper by Moore and Gehr in 2014 and then developed further in later papers. And the idea is that you want to construct a prior probability distribution on waveform differences, delta H of lambda. And these are just defined as the difference between your approximate model, capital H of lambda, minus your very accurate model, or NR waveforms. That's the little h of lambda. Okay, so in practice, so what you'd like to have, assuming you want to do Bayesian inference, and we're assuming stationary Gaussian noise, you can write down a likelihood function. If you write down the likelihood function for the accurate model for the NR waveforms, then this would be it, this L prime. The problem with this is that we only have a couple of thousand of these guys over parameter space, so we can't really sample that directly. So it's not very practical. We can, of course, use the approximate model, capital H, to define a likelihood. So then it just depends on S minus H norm squared, and this norm is relating to this inner product between waveforms and contains the BSD. And S is just the data stream, which is the true signal plus the noise in the detectors. Okay, so this is something we can compute, and that's what we regularly use in analyses. And we hope that it's close to the more accurate likelihood L prime, but of course we can't guarantee that. Now, what Moore and Gehr put forward is the following. So we can write down a likelihood which accounts for the uncertainty in capital H of lambda. And you write that in the following form. You integrate over waveform differences delta H. And you have a Gaussian likelihood here, which is just S minus capital H plus delta H is the same as S minus little h. So that would be the likelihood for the accurate waveform. Or NR, and then you have a probability distribution of delta H. Okay, so we need to do something to put some concrete expression here in order to be able to do something with that. And so what they do is that they assume that this delta H of lambda is the realization of a Gaussian process. So delta H of lambda is drawn from a Gaussian process, in particular with zero mean, because we're assuming we don't really know anything about delta H apart from where we have data. And outside of that, we just assume this to be zero. We don't have any better choice. And it depends also on some covariance function that we need to choose, which tells us about like how are different points in parameter space correlated with each other. And we'll choose that later. And if you make this assumption, then from this Gaussian process, you can get the following. You can get the conditional probability that of delta H of lambda, given some training data D, and that's just the combinations of parameters lambda I and delta H at lambda I. So these will be all the points where you know your NR waveform. Just compute the difference with respect to the approximate model, and then that's your training set. So conditional on D, the probability of delta H is then a Gaussian, which is not a surprise since this is a Gaussian process. I'll say a bit more about Gaussian processes in a moment. And in particular, it has a mean mu of lambda and a variance sigma squared of lambda. So let's take that as a given for the moment, and let's insert that in this marginal likelihood above here. Okay, so we'll see that we have a product of two Gaussians, right? And this is actually a convolution between two Gaussians. Or if you will, you can draw samples from two Gaussian distributions, and you add the samples, and then you know what's going to happen. You're going to add the means, and you're going to add the variances in one dimension. And so if you work that out, you get this equation that this marginalized likelihood is then the following expression. And let's compare that to the likelihood when we're just using the approximate waveform model that we had before. So we had this, Cyndi Gaussian S minus H, the approximate model. So now instead we have a correction to that. We can see that we have a term mu of lambda here. So the mean has been shifted, corrected a bit, which hopefully reduces the bias. And the variance has increased. So that means the posterior distribution will be a bit broader if we use this marginalized likelihood to compute it. Okay. So next, I wanted to say a few things about Gaussian processes. Just for those who are not familiar with that, how can we actually compute this mu function and this sigma squared function that I've just used? So you can think of Gaussian processes as a non-parametric probabilistic interpolation algorithm. You need some training data. So in this case, we had this set D, which includes all of these waveform differences, delta H, at points where we have an R waveforms. And we make the assumption that all of this data in D is drawn from a multivariate Gaussian distribution. And then this is modeled by, in this case, a zero mean Gaussian process with a particular covariance function. We need to choose that. And with this assumption, we can write down this probability of delta H at all the training points, and we can add delta H at a new point that's not in the training set. And that's, again, going to be a Gaussian, zero mean, and a covariance matrix M that can be partitioned into these four things, three things. And so we have this matrix K, which is just the covariance function evaluated at two points in the parameter space, lambda I, lambda j. And this K star is a vector where we have lambda I and then lambda, the unknown point, and K star star is a scalar, just evaluating the covariance function at the unknown, the new point lambda. Okay. And so the final thing we need to choose is just like what form the covariance function should take. We can make the assumption, for example, we want it to be stationary. So it only depends on delta H. And we can say that maybe our data is very smooth. So we say that we assume a covariance function which goes along with this like C infinity assumption on your data. Or if you want less smooth, there are other covariance functions we can choose. So this one is a very simple one that's used quite often. It's a squared exponential. And looking at that function, you can see it obviously depends on lambda I, lambda j. But apart from that, it depends on an overall scale factor, sigma f, and on this g of e, which is just a constant metric. And these are then the only free parameters in this model. And so this is sort of why it's called non-parametric. The free parameters only come in the kernel, and there's only a few of them.
Michael, can I interrupt?
Yes, please.
So this is Eric. So I'm wondering, so the assumption that you're drawing the differences from a Gaussian distribution, is that a completely arbitrary assumption, or is there a central limit theorem that should make me, you know, think that this is, you know, a very good approximation in most circumstances?
Well, I think that will, of course, depend on your data. I think that the central limit theorem is usually what you'd resort to, saying that, okay, if I assume that these deviations actually go to a Gaussian eventually. How justified that is in practice, of course, you have to check. But I think you can, of course, validate the model that you're making. So if you're interpolating some data with a Gaussian process, you want to check on some independent data set that it's actually going to give you a good answer.
Right. And was that done, or is that something that needs to be?
I mean, you need to do it, of course, on every problem where you use that tool. I mean, same with any other fitting method. You need to make sure that you're not overfitting the data. But I'll show you examples below where this is taken into account, that you evaluate, like you check how good this fit is on independent data that's not in the training set.
Okay, so as far as, you know, everybody knows, this is a pretty good assumption.
It's a very good competitive fitting method that's usually much better than polynomials. From experience, it's a very general statement, but it's quite powerful.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Sorry to interrupt, but if I could just sort of jump in too.
Please.
This is Will East.
Hey.
Yeah, so just kind of following up on Eric's question. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if I just think of, for example, the error in like an NR waveform or something due to, you know, finite resolution, usually that error is kind of very consistent, right? Like if you increase the resolution, you'll see some consistent trend. That's kind of, by definition, it's in the converger regime, like you're underestimating the amplitude, or, you know, your frequency is changing too fast, and as you increase the resolution, it'll get converged to the right solution. And I would suspect you would get a similar kind of consistent trend if you compare like the, you know, analytic waveform to the numerical GR waveform, that there'd be some sort of consistent trend in the way that it's wrong. So I was wondering if you could just say a little bit more about the choice of treating that error not as some sort of like, you know, sort of consistent non-stochastic variable, but actually treating as a stochastic variable, as opposed to, for example, just, you know, measuring the error at the points that you have and just assuming that the, you know, and getting some error bars and just assuming the error bars are kind of as bad for the points you don't measure.
I mean, that's certainly a very good question. Not sure I have the really full answer to that. So what can I say? So I think, so one thing is, of course, what you're saying, that if you increase the resolution of your NR simulation, of course, the errors will go down in a certain way and like convergence with a certain order, hopefully. But I guess this is sort of fixed here, and you only have one particular resolution that we're dealing with each simulation that goes into the delta H. And I guess another question is like, how does this, this delta H is something that depends on time, or like, yeah, usually depends on time. You start in the time domain, and the error is not going to be the same at all the time points. Particular assumptions that you can make on that. And so there will be, depending on how you set up your Gaussian process, you can take that into account, how the errors are correlated in time. So that's something that I'll get to later that has been looked at. I think that's...
Yeah, so just to make sure I understand.
These delta Hs that you're using to parameterize your GPR, are you getting those by, for example, comparing the analytic waveform to the NR waveform at particular points? If you worry about the NR, then even comparing the NR waveform at multiple resolutions at the same point too?
Yeah, you could. And of course, to compute that, you'd need to have some common in time so that you can actually compute that. So in this case, it is indeed just a difference between the approximate model at some time grid. Let's choose the same time grid that was used for the NR waveform and then compute this delta H on that. If you wanted to fold in errors in NR, there is a way of doing that as well, which I can make a note later on. But at this moment, you're just assuming that, let's just assume NR is like, doesn't have any further errors, and we'll get to the other point later. Does it make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks.
Then let me go back to that. So I think I was here just describing the Gaussian process and talking about the covariance function. And so this covariance function depends on hyperparameters, which are not determined yet. So this is the scale factor in this metric. And there's indeed a step where you want to train this Gaussian process given your data. And way of doing that is to compute the evidence for your data, or this hyperlikelihood, and this is this expression, and then you want to maximize that all your hyperparameters. And for any evaluations then of this kernel, of this covariance function little k, you're going to use the optimal hyperparameters. All right, given this, one can then show that this additional probability that I talked about before, so P of delta H, given the data, is data Gaussian with particular mean and covariance. And the expressions for those two are given in this box here. They're just in terms of the covariance function. All the k's are the expressions in terms of covariance function, which we had on the previous slide, and then delta H as well. So these then are all known quantities and that can be evaluated. And this is a distribution that of course has a mean and standard deviation. It's Gaussian at every point where you get it. So if you want to, and many people use the Gaussian process actually as a non-stochastic interpolation method in a sense, because they just then take the Gaussian process mean and they get at each parameter point, lambda, they just get a single function. But of course, if you want the uncertainty, you have it, and you can marginalize over that as well. Okay. So going forward, I wanted to show some examples. Actually, just check how I'm doing in time. Okay. So this is from this Moore-Gehr paper, 2014. This is looking at a one-dimensional toy model. You have some waveforms, and you're just looking at chirp mass. And the most accurate waveform is going to be played by a 3.5 post-Newtonian waveform. And the more approximate one here is the 3PN waveform, so less orders in PN, so it's not quite as accurate. And it's just as an illustration of course, if the signal is going to be the more accurate one, and then you recover the signal with the less accurate one, you expect that if you set it up correctly, you'll get a bias in the distribution and the posterior. And since this is a one-dimensional model, it's in chirp mass, they actually set it up on a really small grid in parameter space. It's just 5 points here. It's one-dimensional, so there are only two hyperparameters to optimize in the kernel. So one was this overall scale factor, and the other one is this metric, which in this case is just a constant. And for this example, they put a signal at two solar masses in chirp mass into the data, and is actually using an average noise realization. It's called zero noise. And then looking at what is the delta H that you will get. So I guess that's the mean, yeah? So that's the Gaussian process mean, mu, as a function of different chirp masses. And it's coming towards this grid from the left. So this point here is actually the first point in the grid. This is 1.99. And these are outside of the grid. And so it goes to zero because the choice was made to have a zero mean in this prior for the Gaussian process. Okay, so that's one thing you can see. The other thing you can look at is what is the variance, so the uncertainty of the Gaussian process, how does it behave? So here we have the training points at these red circles, and the variance is zero there, so this is because we really know what the delta H's are there. But in between, the variance is increasing. And if you leave this domain where your training data has support, then the variance keeps increasing quite a bit more, which is not actually on the scale of the plot. You can't see it. It goes up to this value sigma f, the overall scale factor of the kernel. And then it reaches a constant eventually. There will be a plot from the second paper where you can see it better. And then finally, there's a comparison between the different likelihoods that we looked at. So we had the exact likelihood, and the signal that's in the data has a particular chirp mass of 2 solar masses, and the exact likelihood peaks there, as it should. If you use the approximate model, then you get a bias. So this posterior, this likelihood, peaks away from the true value that's in the data, because it's a different model. And then here is the marginalized likelihood. And you can see that the bias is almost zero. And there's maybe a little bit of broadening depending on how you set up your grid, how many points you have in this approximation. And you've also lost a little bit of amplitude. So that's the behavior. As expected, this is basically the same kind of example from the second paper here, Moore et al. 2016. It's again a one-dimensional toy example in chirp mass. The waveforms are slightly different. So there's a phenom waveform as the more accurate one and a PN waveform as the less accurate one, the approximate model. I guess that's labeled the wrong way. And then here is the plot of the overlap between this Gaussian process model and the accurate waveforms. And what you see is what you expect, of course, that at the training points, which are these blue lines, you get an overlap of 1. So you get exactly the correct waveform. And in between, it deteriorates, so the overlap decreases. And especially if you leave the support of your training data, it will eventually go to a constant, but the overlap is not very good. So this is not a very useful waveform. But you could tell, I mean, the model, of course, knows where its training data are. And if you're outside of the support, then you know that you may not be getting a good answer. And of course, you can also check the variance of the GP. And it will tell you how uncertain it thinks that this prediction is. I guess that's more of the same looking at the variance. And so now here we see, of course, the picture, the variance is small at the training points. And if you leave the support of the training points, then eventually it goes, in this case, it goes to 1 because it's the variance divided by the scale factor sigma f squared. And this is done for 2 different grids. So the behavior is a bit different if you have a finer grid with more grid points, reduce the error in between the grid points. Okay. And then finally, again, a similar plot for the likelihoods. But here, so we have, just looking at the first panel here, again, we have 3 different likelihoods. So we have, I guess in black is the exact likelihood. In orange, we have the approximate likelihood, which gives a bias. And then in blue is this marginal likelihood, which gets rid of most of the bias, not all of it. But it does a pretty good job. And then what's interesting is like what's happening if you increase the strength of the signal that you're putting in. So you increase the signal to noise ratio from left to right. So we have SNR 8, 16, 32, 64, making it very loud. So what happens eventually is that, of course, the approximate model will give a completely wrong answer in terms of like the true value is like at a very, like very far in the tail. In the posterior. And the other interesting thing you can see is that the approximate model and the true likelihood, the black one, both of these likelihoods, this distribution, their variance decreases quite steeply. So it should go with 1 over SNR. But that's not the case for this marginal likelihood. This actually goes to a constant distribution in a limit of infinite SNR. This is because there is this variance from the Gaussian process that's also entering in this variance. Okay, so this is a demonstration of why this technique is useful by using this approximate likelihood, which we can actually compute in practice. So we can't really compute the black one because we don't have the NR waveforms everywhere. So the blue one is giving a pretty good answer in terms of the true parameter. Okay. Then I guess there are particular additional things I could say. I think I'll mention this one briefly, that so far this paper or these papers have made the assumption that the model errors are all frequency independent, or you could say that the frequency bins, delta H of the frequency bins is perfectly correlated. And this assumption is probably not what you want, or there's a way of improving this behavior by introducing an additional covariance function frequency. And that's actually what's done in the next paper that I want to talk about. This is a model in a paper by Williams et al. From 2020. This is a way of constructing a precessing in a surrogate model using Gaussian process regression. And in this particular setup, they only have a fairly small number of NR waveforms. It's 132 precessing NR waveforms from, I think, the Georgia Tech catalog. And they're only using the 2-2 mode, so it's not really the full waveform. And they have this joint Gaussian process in the seven parameters that you would care about, like the mass ratio and the six spin components, but also they include the time before merger. This makes the data set quite a bit larger, which leads to some computational problems. But it's really exploring this technique, which hasn't been done before, so it's quite interesting.
Michael?
So there are a few...
Hey, Michael, yes. Sorry. Hi, this is Salvo. Nice to see you. In the previous slide, is there a reason why only the 2-2 mode was used, even though everything is available from NR?
Well, you have to ask Jonathan for sure. I don't quite know. I think it's just a demonstration of how to use this technique without building a full-fledged model. That would be my guess.
It's just faster, pretty much?
It's less work to do that, right?
All right, thanks.
But maybe we can come back to this point in the discussion session. So about this model, I just wanted to show a few plots that relate to the accuracy of the model. Here's one, which is just the accuracy of the model on the training set. So you build this Gaussian process interpolant on the full data set of waveforms, the 132 NR waveforms, and you get this black histogram of the mismatch of this GP model against the original NR data. Okay, so this is not perfect, but it's pretty decent. Most of it is below 1%. And there's some comparison against models that I think we can skip for now. The second plot shows the, if you check the accuracy of the model on data that was not included in the training set. So this is this leave one out cross-validation setup where you say, okay, I have 132 waveforms in total in my data set. I'm just going to build a surrogate from 131, leave one that I don't include in the training set. I'm going to test the accuracy of my model on the remaining one. And then I repeat that process with different training sets 132 times, and then I get an error histogram, which should give me a better estimation of my generalization error. What was actually the error in the surrogate when I evaluate on points that were not used in its construction. And here we can see that these mismatches are not as good, so they are fairly high. And why exactly that is, maybe we can again come to in the discussion session. I don't know for sure, but maybe Jonathan has a few things for us to understand that behavior better. It's certainly a very interesting technique, but it would be good to understand what one need to do to get it to have accuracy that we usually require in data analysis, which would be 1% or better in the mismatch. Right. Here's an example from this same paper of what a waveform would look like. And in particular, you could see from the GPR model, there are two different sets of curves that are shown. So there's the TPR mean, which is this gray dashed curve, which you can sort of see hiding behind some of the other lines. And then there are these very thin gray lines, and these are just draws from the GP. So that is actually, each time you draw, you get a different realization. If you take the mean over those, you should get the dashed gray curve. And then how does this TPR model compare to the NR waveform at this point and to other waveform models? And I guess you can see that visually, and you can compute mismatches. And I think what's shown in the right is in terms of taking these TPR draws and then computing mismatches between these and the waveform models, the UB interphenol model, you get these mismatch distributions. And the lines, I think, are if you take the GPR mean and then compute the mismatch against UB and phenom. So that's only a single waveform, of course. And these are pretty decent. But if you go away, if you include these perturbations, these uncertainties, then of course you'll get waveforms that are away from the best fit waveform that the model has learned. Okay. Okay, maybe come back to particular issues later. So there are two more things I wanted to talk about, and we'll see whether we can fit that in the time. So the first one is actually a slightly different question. So it's the question of suppose you have some unmodeled physics in your signal, and how would you learn about that? Because if your template model doesn't know about the particular physics, it's not going to see that if it's orthogonal to the model. It cannot extract that information. And that's a paper by Edelman et al. In 2020. And they do something slightly different. They say, okay, let's say you have some waveform model. Let's call it HM in the Fourier domain. These are the polarizations of that model. And let's say I will consider a model that perturbs around the space model. And so I'm going to add a delta A of F and a delta phi of F, which are some functions that I want to model. Let's say I want to model them as cubic splines. And then at particular points in frequency, I want to model them as Gaussian processes along with some frequency grid. And if you do that, then you can get posterior distributions in inference for delta A and delta phi. And so here are some example results on some mock signals. So if you just infer a GR signal, then that's the standard posterior distributions in the normal waveform parameters will be the same as before, because there's nothing interesting happening, no deviations, nothing's getting pushed around. And if you look at delta A and delta phi as a function of frequency, like zero is going to be in the middle of that distribution pretty much. And then the uncertainty is going to increase, I guess, towards high frequency because you'll have less SNR probably. So this is pretty boring, nothing interesting happening here. What you see in the right panel is a case where the signal that was injected, that's being analyzed, has a jump in the phase around 100 Hertz. The motivation is this would be an extreme case for spontaneous scalarization. And one can see that the spline model can pick out in its posterior that there's something going on. Like zero would lie at a pretty extreme quantile in the posterior distribution, close to zero or close to one. So that's interesting. It has found something that's not described by the base model. Okay, given this model, you can, of course, also analyze actual gravitational wave events. This is an example of what that would look like. It's not as extreme as in this synthetic example. And here's a summary plot of what they find using a statistic that looks at whether the spline model is favored or disfavored in terms of this DIC, where you have like an average likelihood and you have a penalty term. Your model gets penalized if you have many additional parameters. And if they don't find anything more interesting in the data than the base model, then the model should be disfavored. And that's happening for most of the gravitational wave events here. Most of them have negative value of this TSC difference, and one of them is around zero. In the synthetic signals, you have to put in a big phase jump, then you can see that the spline model is actually favored. So I think it's an interesting interesting approach to learning about things that you haven't included in your template waveforms that you're using for the analysis. And it actually connects well with something I want to talk about next, which is coming back to the original topic, namely including errors in the waveform model and marginalizing all these errors. So that's work with Stephen Green at AI, and it's talking about a particular effective on-body waveform model that we made a few years ago. And I had to say a bit about this model. So there's sort of the uncalibrated UV model, which is like, okay, it depends on some physical parameters like mass ratio and spins, but it also depends on some degrees of freedom that should be tuned against numerical relativity data. And so these calibration parameters, theta. So there are four of these guys. And there's some in our data against which you want to tune that. Okay, and so how this was done was to say that, okay, for each NR waveform, we're going to compute a posterior distribution in calibration parameters, theta. And to do that, came up with a likelihood that includes a measure of distance of the UV waveform with respect to NR, and some difference in the merger times. And then if you sample that, you get posterior distributions for these four calibration parameters for each NR waveform. And it was done, what was done in the original UV model that's coded up was that there was some post-processing of these posteriors and then taking the means and fitting the means to polynomial fit, which then gives you a mapping of determining the calibration parameters given a physical parameter space point. Okay, so that's the standard model that some people know about that's been used in LIGO. Now, we can do something else given that data of the calibration posteriors. We can make a model that is sort of a distribution of waveforms at each parameter space point. So we can determine this P of H given lambda, and then we can interpolate that distribution and parameterize it in an efficient way using amplitude and phase deviations. Okay, and so the way the ansatz that we took is basically the same as this Edelman et al. Paper, and actually goes back to what's being used in LBK for marginalizing or detector calibration errors. So you have a base waveform and you're multiplying this correction of delta A and delta phi on top of that, and you're modeling these functions, delta A and delta phi. And in this case, we set it up such that, so we have the data at each in our simulation, we have the uncalibrated model and we have the calibrated model. We can draw samples from the uncalibrated model, randomly sampling in theta. And then we take this waveform difference, we translate it into the Fourier domain, into amplitude and phase deviations, and we approximate this distribution that we're sampling by normal distribution. And once that has happened, we compute a Gaussian process from that. And then we have an efficient model for these deviations, delta A and delta phi. Okay. Then you can put back, can put together this model called CE here for calibration errors, put that on top of a fast UV waveform so we can actually do inference. So as you've been now before, ROM, here's the base waveform, multiplying this correction on top of it. These corrections are now parameterized by some parameters epsilon, which are actual sampling parameters. There are 20 of them in total. And this parallels how this is done in LIGO for marginalizing over detector calibration errors. So that means that these are additional sampling parameters, and we actually get posteriors for these Okay, and now I want to show a few plots from a study where we do inference on some signals, and the signals are going to be something very accurate. So we took a numerical relativity surrogate model, line spin, and we're recovering with this model that I just described. So sampling in the usual parameters and in the error parameters epsilon. The sampling, of course, also as a check in the NR surrogate model, that there will be the exact posterior that we get. And then as a cross-check, we can also use the base model or use this error model with epsilon to zero. And those two are basically the same. And we do that for four different SNRs to see what's happening. Like, when do we actually see the effect of the posterior becoming broader when we include the errors? So this is a plot that shows the trap mass posteriors. The lines are showing the posteriors for the NR surrogate, and the signal is NR surrogate. And this is peaking at the dashed lines around 32 solar masses. And you can see that for high SNR, these lines get very close to that. And the shaded posteriors are for the model that includes the errors that I've just described. And you can see that those are wider. Look at a few other plots to see a bit better what's going on here. If you look at the lowest SNR and the highest SNR separately, we see in the lowest SNR case, like, most of these posteriors are very similar. And looking at the highest SNR, we can identify what we saw before in this in the Moore and Gehr paper. So that we have an exact posterior, sort of the template waveform is the same as the signal waveform, and we are working in the zero noise realization, where it's averaged noise realization. Which means that the likelihood will actually peak at the correct value of the true signal, and the posterior will as well in this case. And then we have the approximate models, which are these two that do not include any error information, but they're different from the signal. And so they will give a bias eventually if the SNR is high enough. And then there's this model that would correspond to this marginalized likelihood. In this case, the marginalization is not happening analytically, but we have these error parameters in the model, these epsilons, and we're marginalizing numerically over those. And you can see that this is quite a bit broader here. And then how does this depend on SNR, the standard deviation of the chirp mass? You can compare the two, and you'll see that for like the surrogate model and the UB model without error parameters, it goes like the SNR, so as it should go approximately. But this one does not. It has a different behavior. It sort of looks like a power law, but it really shouldn't be. So according to the Moore and Gehr paper, if we take this analogy, what should be the behavior is that we have this square root of 1 over rho squared. This would give us the 1 over rho if we take the square root. This term wasn't there. And then we have the second term, which is this added variance from the Gaussian process model. And that will make it so that eventually for high SNR, this will just go to a constant variance. So this curve is just going to slow down even more and more, and then it's just going to stay at a particular value. Okay, I'm going to wrap up very soon. So one more thing I wanted to mention. So there's some ongoing current work for the successor model, SUBNRV5, that we're currently working on at AI. And the idea was to maybe do something a bit better for factoring in the errors in the model. A more flexible model of the errors. Again, we have posterior distributions in the calibration parameters. And we can use that information to train a model. Before, this was just taking the means and then making a polynomial fit, which is, worked to get a fairly accurate model, but we could have a more more sophisticated model that also includes information on a distribution. And it could be a GPR or it could be something else. And in this case, what I'm using is a mixture density model, a mixture density network, which is just a mixture of Gaussians. So we represent these calibration posteriors as a mixture of Gaussians with some mixture weights and parameterization for the means and the covariance matrix. In this case, this is done through a neural network. And this then learns what the distribution looks like given the posterior data. So this is an example for one of these calibration parameters. It's a function of symmetric mass ratio. At each symmetric mass ratio value, you get a one-dimensional PDF from this mixture model. And you can compute the mean of that, and that goes pretty well through the data points. And well, eventually we can use this model once everything is finalized, of course, to also make draws and then fold uncertainty into analyses. If the UB model that contains all degrees of freedom is fast enough to evaluate, then this is also something you can do in practice. Okay, this is another parameter showing the same thing. Let me wrap up here and maybe give a little bit of a summary of what I've talked about. Quite a few different approaches. What I currently see as the state of the art of including waveform uncertainty. So I hope I haven't forgotten any works that relate to that. So the first one was to build a Gaussian process of the waveform differences, delta H. And if you do that, it's very nice because you can marginalize analytically over delta H. You will not have a posterior for the deviations, but you get an efficient likelihood that you can compute. The second way I described was modeling deviations in amplitude and phase instead. And I think the reason is why we want to do that is because it's just a lot easier to model that in terms of, like, if you look at what an amplitude difference and a phase difference looks like compared to a difference in the strain or in the mode, this is very oscillatory in delta H, where these are much more smooth functions. It's easier to model. The downside here is that you don't get a Gaussian process for delta H. Because I mean, you have to take the exponential of this delta phi, so this is not going to be Gaussian. You can, as I showed, you can marginalize over these errors numerically, either with parameters or you could take draws of Gaussian processes. And as shown in this Edelman et al. Paper, you can infer deviations for delta A and delta phi, which is also an interesting approach of learning about behavior that you haven't included in your model. Thinking about the precessing GPR model that I've presented. So this one takes the approach of actually directly modeling a waveform quantity or the entire waveform in terms of the GPR. If you do that, you can then, of course, compute the mean, or you can take draws over that waveform. And in principle, you could do inference over these draws, marginalizing over these errors. And finally, I've talked about a way of, like, you have a waveform model that includes physical parameters and includes error parameters or uncertainty parameters, which need to be tuned. And then you have a separate model that tells you that, okay, these are the best fit values given in our data, and this is what you should be using if you want the best waveform. But there's an uncertainty around that, and if you like, you can include that, and you can take draws from that, and you can marginalize over it. I think that's basically everything. So we can stop here and then go to the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael, for a wonderful overview. Maybe let's start with questions for Michael, maybe directly regarding the talk, and then we can, like, gradually segue into a longer discussion on also more broader topics. So maybe why don't we start with maybe questions from the online audience first? I noticed we have a few online participants today. Any questions from the Zoom world?
Yeah, maybe one quick question. So thanks for the nice talk, Michael. Yeah. So, for example, if we're thinking about the scenario of, we make some detection and it seems like with our best fit models, there's some deviation. So like some deviation from DR. And then then everyone will start worrying about all these modeling errors and sort of how much you can trust the error bars. So based on all these like kind of experiments that people have done, do you think for any of these particular methods, the sort of errors that the, for example, GPR method or something are giving you, the estimates on the error are sort of sufficiently conservative that you would actually, if it seems like your data is like a four sigma deviation from what the GPR model is saying is the mean value, that you would trust that to make some claim of a possible deviation from GR, or are those kind of not sufficient? There's not enough, the kind of error on the error is not good enough to make such a strong statement?
That's a very interesting question. So I think this hasn't been really explored in a study yet, and I think it should be. So I think in terms of the tools that I've talked about, the papers, the studies, the one that most directly would apply and would give you some information is this paper by Edelman et al., which has this model for amplitude and phase deviations, which explicitly gives you this posterior that may look like this, or it may look more crazy. If you see something where where it's like the posterior is very far away from zero, like for a particular frequency region, then that should make you suspicious that there is something in the phasing of your model that's not included in this, that the signal has a different phasing than your model. And that could be a clue of what to do. How strong that kind of test is, or how you would define a particular test, a particular deviation from zero, how to set that up, I don't know. That's worth thinking about. In terms of the other models, it's I guess you don't get a very clear answer of like what's different in the signal. What are you going to get when the marginal posteriors, so these posteriors that include errors, will be like more washed out. They will have some bias, but it's hard to tell what exactly would happen. I guess I've not thought about this scenario. It's a very good question.
Thanks.
Any other online questions? Time? Okay, well, if not, then let's start here. Max?
Hi, Michael. Thanks. This is Max. I was wondering if you had a sense for how degenerate the waveform calibration would be with the detector calibration. I mean, it seems if you're implementing both as splines, I mean, there's a difference in how the training comes out, but in practice, it might be that you just need one of them, or the largest one, I guess. So have people looked into this?
I mean, my sense would be that the detector calibration, if you just run with detector calibration, I think actually in the study with Carl, we did that. And it's possible if you have like high enough SNR and you have deviations between the model and the signal, which of course there will be, that the detector calibration actually absorbs some of that deviation. So we'll try to minimize that and marginalize over it. So that could be a problem if you include both. But I think you have some level of control about which model is stronger and like influences the posterior more by setting the priors. So depending on how you set up that model, you have more and less control. So in the scenario that I described in this paper, the Edelman et al., or in the paper, the study with Stephen, we have control about it because we have priors for these deviations in amplitude and phase. If you have the other situation that you have a GPR model and you're just taking draws from a GPR and you're marginalizing over that, then, I mean, it's not clear how exactly you would control the level of deviation. So I don't know how it would apply there. But it's a practical, it's an important question again that I think should be looked at. So thanks for bringing that up.
Michael, this is Salvo. I can add something to this topic. So I actually think we won't have a problem on this at all, because over the last year and a half, both my group and the group at Monash have shown now regarding instrumental calibration, instead of using spline, the spline method that we have been using so far, an alternative and, in my opinion, better approach is to use directly the whole response function of sets measured by the calibration group, right? So basically, instead of, you know, sprinkling 10 spline points and then feed it, which imposes a totally artificial correlation length depending on where you put the spline points, you can basically use directly the curves that the calibration group has provided, like, you know, this. Right now, we are only using the envelopes, pretty much, but they have individual draws, mm-hmm. so you can use those individual draws, and that gets rid, basically, entirely of this correlation, which otherwise, I agree with you, would be there. However, so that, like, new way of doing things can be done either at the sampling level, where basically you just let your sampler know that the calibration group has provided this, like, 10,000 draws from the calibration, you know, response function, and those become new parameters you sample on. Or the Monash group, so that's what we have been focusing on. The Monash group has focused instead on doing this as a resampling step after P. But either way, it can be done. But the other thing I want to say, that even if we still kept doing things as we are now, I don't think things would be entirely correlated, because the calibration spline realizations would be different in each detectors, while I would assume what's wrong in the waveform will be wrong in the same way in all detectors, modulo projection effect from the sky, right? Mm-hmm. So they would not be entirely tangential, so to say.
That's true. Yeah. Thanks, Salvo. Yeah, that's I've not been following very closely how these calibration models were progressing, like in terms of like being actually implemented and used in analyses. So that's very encouraging that that there's some progress there, and we have even better models now. So thanks.
Hi, Michael. This is Ricardo. Great talk, by the way. So earlier in this week, I don't remember whose talk was that, basically was shown that around signal to noise ratio 100, we hit on calibration error. Here you're showing that around the same SNR, basically we hit on waveform systematics. So, I mean, what is the take home message? That basically, unless we really do something substantially better, SNR 100 is kind of the best where we can hope to measure, tiny GR effects. Is it so, or am I wrong?
That's a very difficult question to answer, I think. I mean, on the one hand, I think you're giving a good and accurate description of the situation, that as we go like to SNRs of around 100, our current models would probably lead to biased posteriors. That statement, of course, depends on which events you're analyzing, like where exactly the signal is in parameter space. If it's equal mass non-spinning, it's going to be easier than if it's mass ratio 10 and eccentric, right? So that's difficult to say, and you need a study to say that more clearly. So how this relates then to being able to infer deviations from GR? I'm not really an expert on this. I mean, I'm an interested outsider, I would say. what's the best handle we have on that. So if someone else wants to weigh in, then please. Yeah,
let me rephrase my question. Basically, if I aim to measure anything that will show up only above signal-to-noise ratio 100, should I give up? should I give up in hoping to measure anything that can only show up in waveforms at SNR larger than 100? This is probably not only for waveform systematic, but also for calibration uncertainties. I mean, the two things seems to converge in telling me this. Am I wrong?
I think the calibration uncertainty is less of a problem. I wouldn't worry about it that much. So in terms of the impact on that, so I guess there are some studies, have been some more in-depth studies since then. Carl and I tried to fold it into our analysis a little bit, and we had like a very, very rough estimate of when the detector calibration error will actually become important. And that's not until like late in 3G. So at least that was the last time I thought about this, and but maybe someone knows better. So I think that's not the biggest problem. The lack of accuracy in our waveforms is certainly the big one. How do you? So I guess the question is like, what kind of how different would the non-GR waveforms be from the GR waveforms? And like,
no, really non-GR. I mean, I'm not really not interested in non-GR, but you know, even within GR, okay, there are a lot of subtle effects that show up at IPN order, you know,
okay,
and you may want to may be able to measure only at very high signal to noise ratio.
It's more about extracting some of the interesting physics that we haven't really been able to say for sure that we've detected. Okay. That's also, I guess, I mean, the waveform models are continually improving in the sense that like people are trying to incorporate new effects. I guess we've taken over the last decade or so, made a lot of progress with processing waveforms. And I think now we have quite good models, and even some of them more accurate than others, but there has been a lot of progress there. And the next frontier might be folding in eccentricity. And that's certainly going to happen like from analytic information from NR, people will try, but of course it's going to be much harder because the space is so large. How many NR simulations do we need to cover that space? I mean, I wouldn't really give up completely like being able to infer these effects. I think we will see some of them, but it's going to be a lot of work to improve the models further.
Yeah, sure.
But I'm sure other experts on waveform modeling have also their own opinion on that.
And I guess my question was more for a wider discussion. Yes, thank you.
Hey, Michael, this is Reed. Thanks for the great talk. So I wanted to quickly respond to some stuff that Ricardo and Salvo brought up. I also put a paper recently out about calibration uncertainties, and this was an attempt to use a Gaussian process model for the full calibration uncertainty, and then see how far you can get analytically, which is further than you can get on a computer because numerically taking determinants is hard. But one thing that pops out of that I think is related to what Ricardo asked, is that the size of the effect that you're going to see from either waveform uncertainty or calibration uncertainty is going to be bounded above something like the smallest eigenvalue of your prior uncertainty. So if you have like in your waveform uncertainty, some sort of prior that wiggles everywhere and it wiggles at all frequencies independently, right? That is going to have a relatively small eigenvalue. But if you have a model like some of the ones that I think you showed here, Michael, where you have strong correlations between frequencies, right, in your prior for like how the waveform can go wrong, unless your GR model matches up with those exactly, you can actually learn how the waveform is wrong in a way that is orthogonal to like the deviation in GR. And it's very sensitive to sort of the prior covariance. But the basic thing is if you have a super strong correlation, you have a zero eigenvalue in your prior matrix. And therefore, like there is no lower bound to how well you could learn this stuff. You just need a really large SNR signal. And anyway, so I can talk about that more later. But I did actually have a question instead of just advertising my own work. Sorry. In some of the analytic marginalization papers, and maybe John can correct me during the coffee break, but do you have to worry about correlated errors in the waveform at different masses and spins? So like at each mass, I have a marginal uncertainty in my waveform, but that uncertainty could be like if it's at 1.4 or 1.4, I might get it wrong in the same way at 1.45, 1.45. And therefore, when I try to do my sampling, do I want to sample over the analytically marginal like 1D type thing, or do I have to include the correlations when I do that marginalization? I don't know if I made that clear, but it's also super technical, so apologies.
Yeah, that sounds like a difficult question. I'm not sure. Maybe John has a good answer to that already, because he thought about that.
I can give an answer. Whether it's good or not is difficult. So, I mean, I think this is something we do need to think about. In the early GP work, we've essentially assumed the errors in numerical simulations are either zero or uncorrelated different simulations. It's not hard to allow for correlations if you have some reasonable estimate for them or model for them. You're basically just adding another matrix to the guessing process, correlation matrix. So it can be done. So if we have good reason to think this might be the case, then we should be doing it.
Okay, maybe it's a great time now to segue into the sort of broader discussion.